a grateful recovering alcoholic. A preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denominations, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Thanks for reading.
It's great to hear.
And I've asked Ashley to read the 12 steps.
All right,
Ashley.
Hi, I'm Ashley. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thanks for your
And I've asked Anthony to read the set-aside prayer.
Set aside prayer. Dear God, please set aside anything I think I know about myself, about my illness, about the big book, the 12 steps, the program, the fellowship, the people in the fellowship, and all spiritual terms, especially you, God, so that I may now have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please help me see the truth. Amen.
And freedom.
Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Ashley from Quakertown.
Do we need the microphone? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't have to use that? Great. Thank you.
There we go.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Ashley. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah, Ashley.
All right. So I wanted to start off by reading the daily reflection because I felt that it played a lot into my story, that I am here to tell you guys my experience, strength, and hope. February 12th, the root of our troubles. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. How amazing the revelation that the world and everyone in it can get along just fine with or without me. What a relief to know that people, places, and things will be perfectly okay without my control and direction. And how wordlessly wonderful to come to believe that a power greater than me exists separate and apart from myself. I believe that the feeling of separation I experience between me and God will one day vanish. In the meantime, faith must serve as the pathway to the center of my life. I just felt that really, you know, I read that today, this morning, and I just felt that really connected with what I'm going to share with you guys today, so I felt that I should read it. I always start my story by saying that I am an alcoholic because I like to drink. I am not an alcoholic because my parents like to drink. I am not an alcoholic because my parents drank. I am an alcoholic because I like to drink. Alcohol to me is as important as food and water. You know, it's right up there in my basic needs when I take that first drink. To give you guys some backup information, I was born into a family of alcoholics, a long line of family alcoholics and drug addicts. So the instability started at a young point in my life. I had no idea what boundaries were. There wasn't a, you know, a pure, precise view for me to have of like what love looked like in a healthy way. There was just lots of chaos, to say the least. And growing up with that, you know, shaped my appearance on like what I thought alcohol was and what it did. When I was very young, you know, my parents had tons of parties and tons of friends, and they would come over all the time, and everybody would be up all night, and everyone's having like the time of their life. So from an early age, I was like, this is great. This is what this does for you. As I got older, you know, those friends started to vanish. The alcohol started to take the love out of my home, very quickly. My story is mixed with mental health. I am a mixed boat that way. That played a lot into my disease rapidly, progressing. So, I think the first time I remember telling my mom that I, you know, I missed something that I didn't know was there. You know, I was like 4 years old in the back seat of the car. And I remember telling her that I missed something and I didn't know what it was. I now know that feeling as like sadness or depression. But, you know, as a four-year-old, I didn't have the words to vocalize that. Me as a mom today, like I look back at that and I would have, you know, oh my gosh, if my child told me that, I'd want to go home and drink too. You know, I have empathy today for that. My childhood was, you know, I didn't feel like I fit in. I always felt kind of like that, you know, that outcast. I was only capable of having one friend. I was very attached. I would just attach to anything that, you know, made me feel loved and cared about, whether or not that was healthy or not. And that went on for a long time. Before I had alcohol, you know, it was other things. I was addicted to track. I was addicted to boyfriends. I was addicted to friends. I was addicted to just about anything that gave me any sense of feeling happy. Because I was not happy on the inside. Anything to fill the void. They talk about in our big book, and I was trying to find it while I was sitting here. I was a little bit preoccupied with some family stuff going on before I got here, so I wasn't able to find the page that it's on. But they talk about in here that we are, you know, that we are the directors of our lives. And, you know, some of these directors of our lives are like these mean and vengeful people, and some are spiteful. And then they talk about in the last part of the paragraph, and some of them are loving and caring. They will love and care you to where they want you to be in their life. And that was me from a very young age. Always looking, you know, I was gonna love you till you were better. And that was it. So with that type of thinking and that type of like codependency mindset at such a young age, it was just a setup for failure. And, you know, that's what led me to the drink. I had, you know, I don't have this like aha arrived moment with alcohol, about, you know, that I hear some people share about how they, you know, they had their first drink of alcohol and they felt at home in their body. You know, I had my first drink of alcohol with my best friend at her house. We filled the dad's vodka bottle back up with water and then was wonder, you know, put it back in the freezer. And then we didn't know why later he knew we took it. So, you know, go figure. But I remember drinking, and the example I had kind of had at home was that like, you have a good time. You know, I didn't have a drunk. I didn't drink till I got drunk. I drank and pretended to be drunk because that's what I thought it did. You know, it was like this grandiose experience that I was, you know, I felt alcohol had. And my best friend at the time, she got so drunk she couldn't walk. So I took care of her. And that plays the story of my alcoholism progressing. I hung out with people who drank more than me because I took care of them. I was in charge. I was the director. I was going to help you. Even though I'm doing it too on the side, I'm drinking, my life's being demolished. I'm going to help you and love you because you are worse than me. Eventually, you run out of people to be worse than. So, you know, and that went on for all of middle school, all of high school, you know, different boyfriends, different friends, different names, same story. You know, it's just the same trauma over and over and over again because I was the one recycling it for other people. Is that not us? Okay. has it not been an hour? Be a quick hour. So like I said, that went on for a very long time. Just different friends, different boyfriends. I started drinking more, things started to progressing more quickly. I would go, you know, they talk about in here about how we go out and we try controlled drinking, or like sometimes, like, you know, when we're like that stage two alcoholic, we can put it down for a little bit and then we come back to it, and then we put it down for a little bit and we come back to it. But essentially the disease eventually takes over. And that was my drinking for a while. You know, I would drink so much that I would get out of control, and then I'd like straighten up a little bit and I'd be like, oh, like, you know, I can't be like that. You know, I am an alcoholic, and I will say that, because the drink is always the first step for me. My story in particular, you know, involves narcotics. I will refer to them as drinking in this out of respect for the elders in AA. Eventually that the alcohol bottle led to other things for me. And like, that's when things really got wildly out of control. Things at home were pretty rough. Mom and dad were fighting a lot. Mom was being like physically abusive. Marriage going down the drain. Love is like nowhere in sight. I'm going to therapy. I'm lying to my therapist. I'm telling her that I'm not drinking. It's just my friends. I'm not using. It's just my friends. And I have to help them and feed them. You know, at like 17 years old, I have this complex that I'm going to like save my friends that are like 19 and 20 years old outside with like nowhere to live because of where their disease was taking them. You know, lying to my therapist, stuff like that is going on. That goes on for a couple of years. My mom and dad eventually get divorced because that's what alcohol does. You know, it takes things from us. My mom moves. And she goes to a different state, and she has a great chance at getting better because she goes to a good support system, and she starts looking at life differently, and she starts, you know, getting, I don't want to say she was attempting to be sober, you know, her story is not my story to tell, but she definitely was doing better. And I was getting worse. And I, you know, things at home were getting worse. So, and I have to take ownership for this. Because, you know, this is a big part of my story, and that selfishness that it talks about in that I read in the Daily Reflection. My mom went down there, and I knew she got a bunch of divorce money because that's what happens when you get divorced. So I call up my mom, and I'm like, hey, it's your fault I'm on drugs and alcohol. You have to help me. You have to move me out to you. You have to help me. I'm not going to be able to be sober here, you know. And knowing she got a bunch of divorce money and the guilt trip would work, you know, mom's like, all right, well, come on down here, live with us, you know, see if we can get your life on track. And then I think within like 72 hours, I had my mom like back on the bottle. Like, not even, you know, I knew what I was doing when I went down there. I knew, you know, I knew it was a easy way to money and an easy way to live for me at the time, you know. I have to take ownership for that today because that's where my alcohol takes me. My alcoholism takes me when I'm actively drinking to a point that I'm willing to take that away from somebody that I love that much. And not even realizing it. And that was the thing, you know, we don't even realize what we're doing when we're doing it. I was down there with my mom for a long time and, you know, things got out of control. We were drinking, we were using other stuff. I got sexually assaulted twice in less than 1 year. Me knowing I had a whole way out the whole time, I could have just called my dad and been like, hey, this isn't working out. Like, bad stuff is happening. Like, you know, I really need help. And I didn't do that because it was more important to me to get drunk at the time. You know, I'm willing to sacrifice my own safety to get drunk. That's where my alcoholism takes me. So eventually dad has enough. Dad got sober while I was away. You know, he went and got help and was, you know, living a different life. Dad eventually is like, yeah, you're not living there anymore. You're coming home. You know, like, we're done with this. Like, you've destroyed everything. So I get sent back here to Pennsylvania. And once again, in like another 72 hours, I'm found unresponsive on the floor and need a couple of shots of Narcan to wake up. And, you know, that was my story. It was this never-ending cycle of pain and wanting to, and, you know, alcohol was like food and water to me. It couldn't be the alcohol. I was doing everything to manage my alcoholism with my food and water, because that's how important it is. How could it be the alcoholism? So that was my first trip to rehab. I went to this really wonderful and nice rehab that had acupuncture and really nice yoga, and they had a softball team. I've never heard of a rehab having a softball team. It goes to show you how well it works, because the same people are on it every spring. Like, it doesn't work. Really nice rehab. I don't think I told any of these people the truth. The only reason why they even really knew my name is because I went so messed up when I was in there. I was like trying to play tic-tac-toe with the nurses. When I woke up the next day, I had no idea where I was. And I guess, I don't know what they call them at that rehab, the techs or the nurses or the aides that came in to take my blood pressure, asked me if I knew where I was. And I said no. And they're like, oh, well, you're at Miramount Recovery Center. Welcome to sobriety. And I was like, mother effer. Like, you know, it was like my first initial response. And I cried every day to come home. I begged for 14 days. And then, and I wasn't ready. You know, I wasn't willing to accept that my alcoholism was a problem. I was willing to accept that I had gotten caught. I was willing to accept that it was becoming unmanageable, but the alcohol was not the problem. It was that I wasn't doing it correctly. Maybe I needed some more water with food, water, and alcohol. You know, there was something I could fix. I was the director. I could love enough people into fixing it. So I came home from rehab and I drank that day. And I'm not proud of that. And I think I used again in like a week. And I played that game for another 6 to 8 months of hiding it, getting away with it, begging my friends at work, because I somehow maintained, actually I shouldn't say I maintained, I poorly had a waitressing and bartending job that I would fall asleep at the keg. I would like fall asleep. And they just tolerated it because I don't know. They're sick and suffering too, I don't know. But I was begging women I worked with for their children's pee to put in 5-hour energy bottles, and I would go and get hand warmers and tape it around it. So when I would get home and my dad would drug test me, I could pass. And that was the life I was content with living. And it's really sad. I can't tell you the chain of events. You know, other than the fact that it was a God thing, it was a God moment, it was, you know, and I don't have to understand it, and that's the beauty of this program and with the God thing is, like I don't have to understand it, I just have to have some type of hope in it and believe in it, and it'll work for me, it'll do its magic for me, it's what you guys told me. The chain of events that led me to going to rehab was, I was sitting passenger seat in the car I still somehow had, and I would lay in my passenger seat while I let somebody else drive my car with a blanket over my head, and I would just put my arm out for the bottle. And that's all I would do. That was my life. I was nothing. There was nothing else going on inside of me besides for when is my next fix and where is it coming from. I was hiding the Narcan that we used to keep. That was like my thing too. I would hide it because I'm the director and I get to go out when I want, but if something happens to you, I can revive you. You know, and that went on for a couple of months. You know, we totaled that car because that's what happens. Don't drive drunk. Don't drive anything. We totaled that car, so my dad was nice enough to let me use his spare car because I'm supposed to be going to this job I supposedly still had. And, you know, I'm driving to and from work. I rear-ended a lady at a red light, and she got out of the car and told me that she knew I was intoxicated and she was going to beat the ever-loving shit out of me. And her, I guess, a boyfriend or husband or whoever pulled her back in her car and was like, it's not worth it. Like, we're going to get arrested. Just call the cops. It was luckily 2 minutes away from home until I found out that I gave that lady my insurance information, and she called my father the next day and said, you know, some whatever person, you know, rear-ended me last night in your car. So in the mix of that going on and my dad trying to get the keys from me to the car that I was borrowing supposedly from work, I packed a bag of dirty clothes and drove myself to Penn Foundation Rehab and refused to leave until they could help me. I was detoxing so terribly that the insurance lady that they have there that calls the insurance companies brought me into her office because I was scaring the visitors for the mental health building. I was like throwing up and shaking and convulsing on chairs just like these laying out across them. So she pulled me into her office and said, you can sit here till hopefully we get an insurance thing. I called my dad and said, come get your car. Can I please have a pack of cigarettes? Because my alcoholism leads me to believe I still have the right to ask for things when I'm doing things like that. I went into the rehab, and not that Penn Foundation is terrible, but it is not Miramount Recovery Center. There is no acupuncture. There is no yoga. There is a rock hard bed and some lady named Nina that told me that if I left while detoxing, she would beat the shit out of me. and that I was going to have to wait 12 hours for my dose of medication, and that was going to be that, and she would sit outside my room. And, you know, like I said, like I brought up that God thing. Why I was there, you know, like this is a God thing too. I think that was the first time I was honest ever in my entire life with these people there about what I had been doing and what was happening and how I felt. And I decided that if I didn't like any of them again, after my stay at rehab, I didn't really have to talk to them, so I might as well just tell them the truth. So I begged to come home. That was my next big thing. You know, I was saved. You know, these people had cured me of my alcoholism. I was great to come home. My dad said, absolutely not. You're never coming here again. And I said, okay. They sent me to a halfway house. It's like a county-run halfway house because I was technically homeless, so I had no money to pay these people to let me live with them, with seven other women with mental health disorders also trying to stay sober. For this like tough girl that I thought I was, like running the streets and like I know this and I know that. I sat at my first dinner with those ladies and shaked uncontrollably the whole time. I was scared out of my mind. I went outside at the smoking booth that they had there and I sobbed my eyes out for hours. I was so scared out of my, I was so scared. That fear is overwhelming in the beginning. And so they took my phone. They told me I couldn't have a cell phone. I wasn't allowed. I hadn't earned it. They took away all things that I thought made life enjoyable. They told me that I had to do chores and dishes and go to AA meetings and I could earn my phone back with time. So naturally, like a good alcoholic I was, I went to the AA meetings because I wanted my phone. I got a sponsor. Didn't really stick, didn't really do too much because, you know, like the good alcoholic I am, I think your way works, but my shortcuts get me there faster. So I had a sponsor, but I wasn't really doing the step work. I was just kind of calling. I was listening to people in AA, you know, I was doing it like a half job at this thing. And I didn't get any better. I got sicker. I got worse. I cannot explain to you the feeling of wanting to die when you have 6, 7 months, 8 months sober, but it is absolutely terrible. It doesn't have to be that way, and I don't recommend. I got a boyfriend in the first 6 months. That was not a wonderful idea. He was like still using and drinking, but trying to hide it, and I wasn't better, and I was just like repeating processes and doing all this like crazy stuff that they told me not to do because I think I know better, like the good alcoholic that I am. That went on for a little while until there was a God moment that I ultimately ended it. My grandmother on my mom's side they found out that she had cancer again, and they put her in the hospital. And then they did a biopsy, and they punctured her lung, and the only thing keeping her alive was the machine. And it got real. Really, really quick about if I was going to stay sober or if I was going to drink. Because I had no program, but I had a bunch of AA in my head. And I was living at this place that obviously you can't drink to live there. I got a sponsor that time, and I did the steps. Really slow. I'm a slow learner. I did the steps, was a slow learner. I don't have the, you know, they talk about in the book about, you know, that like these like lightning moments when you do like your fourth and your fifth and you feel like super relieved. And I did not. I had to do them again. I had to talk about them again. My character defects are absolutely horrific. I had to talk about them and talk about them and talk about them. And this went on for a while. I think that first year of sobriety for me, truly was a lesson in what it can be like if we don't do what we're told and if we're just not able to be teachable and listen. Life got tremendously better after I did the steps and I listened and I did what I was supposed to do and I prayed and I did my fourth and fifth and I helped when I could, and life got beautifully better. I had friends, you know, I made friends that are real friends that I have like until this day, that actually care about me. When I did the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned how to become a daughter. I learned how to become a sister. I learned how to become an aunt. I learned how to become a friend. I learned how to be an employee. I didn't know how to do any of those things. I didn't have to be a director anymore. I could just be. I could just be a sister. I could just be a friend. I could just be an aunt. And that is a beautiful thing that I never thought I could, that I would ever experience. Since doing the steps and having to go back over them and over them, because, you know, I'm a sickly person, I can get sick just as quick as I can get well. I've encountered, you know, negative things in life and positive things in life. I have a beautiful family now. I was able to become a mom in sobriety. I'm a stepmom with a beautiful relationship with my stepdaughter. I have put the work in through you guys telling me how to put the work in and connect with this child. I got involved when she was 9 and she's 14 now. Some are positive and some are negative. My relationship with God throughout this program has changed tremendously. When I first came here, you guys told me that I didn't have to believe in God. I didn't have to believe in anything. I just had to believe that it helped other people. So that was the beginning of my spiritual journey for me throughout this program. I actually wrote in my, and my dog chewed up the first page, so I wrote it again, that find God or die. I was told by that second sponsor that I did the work with that I was going to find God or die, because if life without God means that I'm God, and I'm a pretty miserable God, pretty, you know, mean and vengeful God, and, you know, so I will die with that type of attitude. And that really has stuck with me. Every time I open up my book, I read that and I think about that. You guys told me that if I thought it would work for other people, it would work for me. It happened slowly for me. You know, that door was kind of opened when I saw God working for other people and like that concept. And slowly over time, you know, I know, you know, it is not like a, I don't know, it's not like a Bible thing. If you ask me what Jesus Christ looks like, I would tell you he probably has tattoos and has a cold one with the boys on the weekends. Like, it's just like what my mind has always pictured as, like, what that would look like. So, you know, I don't have a very, like, orthodox way of thinking about spirituality, but it's true to me and it helps me. And you guys gave me that. You know, my understanding of spirituality is, like, loving and care. When I went for such a long time empty without that, this program has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. If you would have told me that at 25, I was going to be living in an apartment with my boyfriend that we, you know, that is also in AA, which I don't recommend to do that either. That's really hard. I don't recommend it either. First year was pretty rough. But they, you know, that I was going to be living in an apartment with my boyfriend, also in AA, helping him take care of his 9-year-old daughter. My mind would have been blown. I would have been like, not me. Oh, what do you mean? Like, that's, I'm free. Like, whatever that means. If you would have told me at 27 that I would miscarry twins and I wouldn't drink over it, I would have told you that I do not believe you, that I'm not feasibly possible of that. If you would have told me that the same age at 27, I was going to earn my CNA to be able to take care of people and let me work on the hospice area and the COVID unit and take care of these people when they don't have their families to be there with them because the nursing homes are on lockdown and I can hold their hands and braid their hair and do all this with them, I wouldn't have believed you. I'm not capable of that. I can't be a director in that role, you know. And if you would have told me at 29 that I would be standing here in front of all you people, keep looking at my phone because I don't know how long an hour can take, but I talk pretty fast, so I feel like I've told you a lot of information in this very short little bit of time, you know, I wouldn't believe you. And without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not be alive today. I would not be a mom. I would not be a daughter. I would not be a sister. I would not be an aunt. I would not be a friend. I would not be an employee. I would not be anything, and I am truly grateful for that. I know, like, can we share or something? Am I allowed to do that?
We can wrap it up.
Okay, sweet. I don't know what they do with the rest of the meeting if you don't talk for an hour, but we're going to do that now.